Well, I left Sandhurst on being commissioned to the Army, but I was attached to the Royal Flying Corps. And I was posted to Castle Bromwich at the age of 18 to learn to fly. And they took us up in Morris Farm and Longhorns. It's one of the earliest types of aircraft. And they gave us sort of 10-minute trips with a very elementary form of dual control. In some cases, you didn't handle controls at all. Well, after a couple of hours of that, I was sent off solo and offered up a short prayer to God and opened the throttle and then juggled with death as best I knew. Well, after a few hours of solo flying on that type of aeroplane, they then gave me a little bit of duel on a tractor type, a B2C. And I was then posted up to Tadcaster, to another squadron where I did some cross-country flights and night landings. And also height tests, which is all part of an examination for an international aviator's certificate. Well, I misbehaved there a bit by doing rather a lot of loops over Harrogate, and I happened to be seen, and they told me that I was endangering the lives of other pilots by upsetting the rigging of the aeroplane, and they sent me to a squadron type of aeroplane which I couldn't loop. So I was then sent to Norwich, and they took me up for a quarter of an hour in the front seat of an FE-2B. And then told me to go and pack my bag and report to Bolton and Paul's and take a brand new FE-2B up to France via Farnborough. Well, I set off one evening and lost my way and arrived at an airfield just before dark, and there were one or two others also going to Farnborough. And I thought, well, they couldn't know less about navigation than I did, so I tacked myself on to the tail of them, and after a while, as the leader went right down and started circling around a railway station, evidently to read the name of the place, so he was also lost. Anyway, we landed at Hendon, which we happened to see, and then filled up petrol and on to Farnborough. And I was then sent out, told to fly out to France. There were two of us in two different FE-2Ds, which were a brand new type of pusher aircraft. We went off separately. He landed on the wrong side of the lines in Lille, and I managed to arrive safely on our side at Saint-Omer and handed it over. Well, then I was posted to an FE-2D squadron in France. The description of the aeroplane is it was a pusher That means the propeller at the back and the nacelle in the front. And the pilot sat immediately in front of the engine and his observer just in front of him in a small compartment. We never strapped in because if we crashed, we'd get the whole of the engine on the back, so we preferred to be thrown out. That type of squadron, number 20, it was, the role of it was made of all work. It operated on a front of 30 miles from just north of the Ypres salient down to La Bassée, which is just in front of opposite Béthune. We either carried out line patrols or offensive patrols up and down the line to keep enemy aircraft from crossing over to our side, and also protecting our aircraft and balloons, which were carrying out artillery reconnaissance work, directing artillery. We also went up to about 70 miles over the lines on doing reconnaissances, photographic work, bombing, and it wasn't a very glamorous occupation at all. We had to fight our way around continual anti-aircraft fire from the ground. I did 11 months of that, and it gets on your nerves after a bit, being fired at for 2 hours on end or more. Both from the ground and from hostile aircraft. We used to assemble at about 10,000 feet over the our airfield and then start off in loose formation. As I mentioned that our flying clothing were totally inadequate with keeping out the cold, and we bought fur coats and odd things in the hopes of improving matters. But in the winter, it was really dreadful, up at a height of 12 to 14,000 feet for up to 2.5 hours. In midwinter, no windscreen in front, and we suffered severely from the cold and from frostbite as well. The casualties during that period of 1916 and 17 until I left in July 17 were very severe, and to such an extent that when I left, I'd been out 11 months, and the next senior a month, and the others were in weeks and days. I started off, of course, as a second lieutenant. That was in France in July 1916, and I was made a captain and a flight commander in January 1917, and continued as flight commander until I left, return to UK and become a flying instructor. I then realized that I didn't know the first thing about flying. And luckily, I had a squadron commander who also was interested in analyzing the art of flying, and together we managed to got together and get into difficulties and then analyze how we got out of them. A spin, for instance, if you got into a spin in those days, nobody knew how to get out. And the more you tried the usual thing of trying to pull the nose up, the tighter the spin. So it was very interesting analyzing the art of flying with, together with a few others, and Colonel Smith Berry in particular, who started up a school of special flying to instruct instructors so that they could teach pupils something about the art of flying. I went out a second time in January 1918 on Newport Scouts and AC-5s, and eventually collided with a Hun during one of my combats and was sent home on leave and told to have a medical checkup. And they gave me a month's leave, and while I was at home, they posted me to on promotion to squadron leader at the age of 20. And so that was a major. To Northolt. And by the way, during the period I was with 29 Squadron on AC-5s, the Royal Air Force was formed, that is, on the 1st of April, but it didn't mean anything so far as we were concerned in France, because except the naval squadrons who were operating along the coast also came and took part with some of the operational duties on the main northern part of the line. I then went, sent out to command 64th Squadron just after the end of the war, but that was reduced to Cato, and I was sent up to Cologne with the Army of Occupation to command number 29th Squadron. That, in due course, was folded up at the end of 1919. And I then returned to the UK on being given a permanent commission in the Royal Air Force, and then continued in the service for a total of 40 years all told, some of which was, 5 years of which was spent in India on the Northwest frontier, and a further 3 later on in Singapore. I returned from there just before the outbreak of the Second War, and having at one time specialised in aeronautical engineering, I was transferred to the technical branch of the service, and the whole of the war I was occupied in setting up technical training schools, first of all, as senior air staff officer at technical training group, and then I became commandant of number one school of technical training at Halton, which had at that time 15,500 trainees, men, women and boys, apprentices. It included 6,000 WEPs, amongst others, and the hospital, the main Royal Air Force hospital there, 650 beds. Later on, after the Second World War, I was sent out as senior technical staff officer with British Air Forces of Occupation, and we eventually cleared up all the mess out there and came back, and I commanded two further groups. They were both technical groups. And then became, I forgot what they call it now, at Headquarters Maintenance Command, air officer in charge of administration. And I retired from the service in 1955.
When did you achieve the position of Air Vice Marshal?
I became an Air Vice Marshal in 1946.
Must have meant that you met some of the most distinguished people that there were in politics and also in the forces, being in such a, you know, high position. Can you remember stories about any particular people that you met in this way?
Well, Trenchard, for instance, I'd met him a number of times, of course, especially in the first World War.
What sort of man was he?
We called him Boom. He had a very loud voice. And he was a great man. And he was the father of the Royal Air Force. Mm. He had a shocking bad memory for names. He always turned to his ADC, and tell him to make a note of that, or to ask the name of whoever he was coming up to next. On one occasion, I was standing and told to stand in front of my two aircraft. I had an experimental aircraft as well as the ordinary FE-2D that I was flying in, number 20 squadron. And these two aircraft were in two different Besno hangars next door to each other. And having saluted him and tried to answer his question. I was in fear of trembling with this great man. I saluted him and he turned away, and he came into the next aircraft and I was standing in front of that. He said, "Where have I seen you before? I seem to know your face." And I remained silent. And he said, "Speak up, boy, don't be afraid. Where was it?" I said, "The last machine, sir." "Oh, you'd be very quick." He's a remarkable man and very outspoken. If I remember him coming to address one of the squadrons that's got a very poor type of aircraft, and it was just before a big battle, and he said, I don't suppose I shall see many of you again, and I know you have a pretty poor type of aircraft in comparison with the enemy, but I'm afraid there's nothing I can do about it. So I hope you will do your best."
You couldn't be more blunt than that, could you? On the Western Front, Boles, another man who came up through the ranks, and I should think you must have met him.
Who?
Brommel. He became an Air Vice Marshal as well.
That's a German Rommel.
Brommel.
Brommet.
Brommet, sorry.
Brommet.
Brommet.
Oh, yes.
He was on the same front at about the same time as yourself.
Yes.